I'm Carol Cohn, and welcome to Purpose 360, the podcast that unlocks the power of purpose to ignite business and social impact. Joining me today on Purpose 360 is a returning guest, author and academic, Dr. Christopher Marquis, one of the world's leading experts in social responsibility. In September 2020, I had the joy of having a conversation with Christopher about his book, Better Business, How the B Corporation is Remaking Capitalism. Well, in the following years, Christopher really dove even deeper to the practices of corporations around the globe. And in his new book, it is in the beginning, the first part, it's actually a scathing expose of how business leaders who are solemnly professing their dedication to principles of environmental and social justice, unfortunately, their actions betray an enduring commitment to the neoliberal idea of maximizing profit, e.g., let's maximize profit at all costs. And unfortunately, they're hiding behind what he calls the mirage of ESG and corporate social responsibility, with corporations continuing to exploit the very resources and communities essential to their success. But the book is not all gloom and doom, because it turns then in its third section to who are the ripples of change? Who are those companies that have new models, that have purpose at their center, and that they are truly making innovations in products and services and programs that are incredibly exciting? So there is bright light on the horizon in the profiteers. This is going to be an amazing conversation. So welcome back to the show, Chris.
Great to be here. You're looking forward to the discussion, Carol.
Oh, it's going to be wonderful. So for our listeners, I'd love you to talk a bit about your background, and especially, Chris, because you're an academic, but early in your career, according to your bio, you worked in financial services at JP Morgan Chase. I saw that, you know, for 6 years or so. But then you made this tremendous shift.
It's great to be talking to you about this, because actually, when you were asking that, it really brought up some memories of when I was growing up, and actually how some of those experiences may actually play a big role in my professional development. So I'm currently and have been for the last about 20 years a professor, and I teach on sustainable business, social innovation. I'm at Cambridge University, and I've been here for about 2 years now. You know, you and I met actually as my first job out of getting a PhD at Harvard Business School. You and I worked on a number of things together there, one of which was on PNC Financial Services. And I think the fact that banks have always, in the United States, typically been very focused on their communities and aim to give back, actually had a very deep imprint on the work that I've subsequently done and my focus on business sustainability and responsibility.
And so why do you love academia? Why did you switch from business to academia?
I think it's a profession, at least my experience has been that I've been able to have tremendous sort of freedom to be entrepreneurial, to follow my interests, and to do, what I want. I mean, there's no one telling me what I have to research, what I want to write, what I have to write about. You know, I can really follow my passion. And if I think something's important, really dig into it.
And I'm curious, how did you end up at Cambridge in England?
Cambridge had a job opening. And they, it's a pretty high status position here. And they contacted me, and I at first didn't think I would actually take it. I thought maybe small chance, but I'll give it a shot. And I think that after getting to know the faculty here in the administration, and actually the focus on at Cambridge on sustainability, on climate, is just incredible. Cambridge, I didn't realize this. For your U.S. listeners, Oxford is sort of like Harvard, and Cambridge is sort of like MIT. You know, it's much more in engineering, tech school. A lot of the interest, even in computer science and biology, engineering, is very focused on issues of the natural world and climate and sustainability. And so it really felt like it was a great sort of home for this next phase of my career.
Now, I want to turn to the new book, because that's what most of this is going to be about today, The Profiteers.
Sure.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
There's a lot in this book. But I love in the promotional materials that you talk about that your research, it wasn't just pure research. It wasn't just case studies. You said that you looked at investigative reporting, that you looked at court cases, that you looked at peer-reviewed research, and then firsthand case studies. So talk about the genesis of this book. Something gave you an itch. You did that wonderful B Corp book, you know, on the new way of capitalism. We discussed it in 2020, September, so right during COVID. Lovely conversation. Great book. But this is different. This is something's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. You know, it does depart quite a bit from the previous work that I did. I think that there's actually common themes underlying both books and a lot of my work. And that's that I really do think that business as an engine for social good, for environmental good, is like nothing else in this world. I think that the innovation and creativity of business leaders is absolutely essential to solve some of our biggest problems and issues in the world. But, you know, there's a lot of sort of headwinds that they face. I don't think that's the typical business is doing that. My previous book that you mentioned on the B Corp movement called Better Business, you know, when I was selling that to the publishers, many of them said, oh, this is just, it's too good of a story. People want to buy things that are a little bit more controversial and critical. And actually, you know me well. I'm actually someone that really looks on the sunny side of things and is very positive.
Okay.
So that stuck with me. Along the same lines, there's been so many books and academics writing about the positive side of, you know, doing well by doing good, et cetera. So I felt, you know, I should actually dig a little bit more into the challenges and the difficulties of the economic system that exists. You know, there's a lot of people that talk about the problems with, you know, shareholder primacy, where, you know, companies are very, very short-term oriented because of the markets and their investors, which creates a lot of, you know, economic and societal problems. And so I really wanted to dig into that a little bit deeper and a little bit more to understand some of the roots of that system, and then also how it gets manifest through business decisions. So that was really, you know, the genesis. And I must say, you know, as, you know, you mentioned, you know, that you read the book, and certainly I go into the critique in the first part, but, you know, towards the end, I get much more into, you know, areas of the future and reform, where I'm able to draw on some of that, you know, more firsthand work that I've done with businesses, with entrepreneurs that are really trying to make a difference.
So dare I say, from the dark into the light. So,
yes.
So let's get into it. I love early in the book, you're saying business is the cause of current troubles and, though, perhaps the most important cure. So there we go, from the dark and the light. But on the dark side, I love when you say this, hiding behind the mirage of ESG and CSR, and that was like a knife to my heart. corporations continue to exploit, obscure adverse consequences, and hide costs, or offload those costs, as you call them, externalities, to the public commons. So why don't we start out with what is the problem that you really dive into in the first part of the book?
Sure. Yeah. So this idea of externalities, I think, is where I've highlighted a lot of the focus. You know, when companies are really under a lot of pressure for short-term earnings, you know, if they can avoid costs, that goes right to the bottom line. So there's a lot of examples of this where companies are able to exploit externalities. So, you know, carbon emissions is the most famous. You know, there's talks of, you know, pricing and markets in some areas, but in reality, that doesn't really exist yet in a widespread fashion. And so companies pollute. This has a lot of negative effects, you know, health effects in local areas, climate change, global warming effects. You know, one study that I saw, you know, discussed how actually some utility, I think it was in the US, you know, basically had to pay $10 in cost for its coal-fired processes. But there was a calculation that actually it led to $8 worth of health effects, and then another $8 or so worth of other environmental issues like relating to global warming. So really, you know, it should be paying $26. It's the cost that it was, you know, incurring in some ways were $26, but it was only paying 10 of those, and society and the environment paying other sort of 16. And this pattern actually, you know, exists in a lot of other areas like plastic and inequality, you know, do have these issues where, you know, businesses get a free lunch, basically. I use that term in the book. And why I think this is important to highlight is that, you know, many will say, oh, this is just, you know, this is the way economics works. You know, it's a neutral economics concept, externalities, or, you know, we should have the government come in. And I think certainly government, some government solutions might make sense. But actually, businesses are very active, or many businesses are very active in trying to hide or push those costs onto someone else. So around plastic as an issue, very low rates of recycling, but many large companies are just telling you, you know, recycle, recycle, recycle. But probably they should actually be investing in, you know, new packaging, alternative ways of distribution, as opposed to promoting recycling. So that's, you know, some examples.
Let's talk about the public commons. And why do you feel that there are great examples at the end, but that it seemed to be like, you know, whether it's oil and gas, or to your point of packaging or CPG companies, that they're really offloading these.
People probably in their, you know, grade school or elsewhere learned about this tragedy of the commons metaphor, where, you know, there's a commons. There's actually public commons is here in Cambridge, interestingly enough, that people can graze their cattle on. There must be some regulation where there's certainly certain numbers. But, you know, when the commons is free, you know, Farmer Joe, you know, he'll realize, well, I should get another cow. And everyone ends up getting another cow. And then actually all the grass gets eaten. And then all of a sudden there's this collapse. And this has happened in a lot of different markets, you know, like sort of for cod fishing in New England, in other areas. And I think that, you know, this is, you know, relevant for us in the world, because related to this, there's also this Earth Overshoot Day. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's where we've overused the total resources of the Earth. And what happens is, like a public commons, when you keep overusing every year, at some point, you know, there will be a collapse. And I think this is something that, you know, we around climate need to be thinking about very seriously and take a lot of very serious action. So I think that, you know, these externalities do lead to this public commons issue, which is, you know, one of the important reasons why we need to be more enhanced in keeping companies in line.
Regarding the public commons, you ask the question, who pays for the damage? Should a company say, well, you know, we're giving you a product and here's the product and it's a fair price, but there's all these externalities and the hidden costs, your point about climate change, plastic pollution, biodiversity loss, wealth inequality. Who pays for these?
It's people, basically. And I think, you know, the general public, it's interesting how I identified this and got interested in writing a book about it is actually from companies that see this issue and realize it's part of their responsibility. So one company is an example, Grove Collaborative. So I don't know if you know Grove, but they're a company that does, you know, health and beauty kitchen type products. Frequently people get them on subscription, or you can buy individually. The co-founder and current board chair, Stu Landsberg, when I interviewed him, and it really was very influential in how this book was developed, he told me, as we see our social responsibility and sustainability, we focus on plastic because plastic is our biggest externality. And what he meant by that is that, you know, it's a lot cheaper for companies to actually make things out of virgin versus recycled plastic. So he said, actually, we're going to develop a system to have internal tax on ourselves for plastic, and we're going to actively work to remove plastic, to avoid plastic, eliminate it from our products. I firmly believe the current day is very much this, you know, take, make, waste, linear type of model. But I think the companies are going to be much more accountable for their supply chains and for being much more circular in the future. And the companies that are getting behind this now are actually learning how to do this and able to be sort of pioneers and leaders in the future.
You talk in the book about those who are forward thinking, and you talk a lot about Emmanuel Faber, and I want to talk about him because he was one of my heroes. But there's also the issue of regulation, and the EU is much further ahead than the US, and then you have EPR laws that are popping up in states. So is this going to be voluntary? Is it going to be regulation? What's the balance?
Yeah, I think that definitely there's going to be both voluntary and more state-oriented regulation. Only a small part of companies are ever going to actually do this voluntarily, I think. I think this is something where we need to actually have much more rigorous policy. I think that, you know, something like plastic, you know, we have all been sort of schooled in the mantra of, you know, reduce, you know, reuse, recycle. And I think that obviously, if we have something, we should recycle it. But that shouldn't be our choice. You know, like we should actually be able to avoid like products like plastic that actually are damaging, and companies should take more responsibility, like Grove Collaborative or Seventh Generation, to reformulate products to avoid plastic. You know, companies like Pepsi and Coke, instead of actually, you know, sort of promoting their plastic recycling, which they do in television advertisements and all this stuff, should actually be working to, you know, use different materials that actually can end up being recycled.
Let's talk about Danone. And then we'll talk about, because Danone, I mean, Emmanuel Faber, he really tried very hard in so many ways to reinvent that company. And he was, you know, everybody talks about Paul Polman, who we love. And I've had Paul on the show. But you have to know a little bit more of the inside about Danone. And so can you talk about this issue of alignment?
You know, like you mentioned, you know, have tremendous admiration for him. You know, he really tried to make Danone a truly sustainable, focused on certain SDGs. During COVID, for instance, he took a pay cut. The board took a pay cut. You know, they delivered that to the farmers and to the employees. You know, I think this idea of putting your money where your mouth is really, really important. He wanted to have a business that, you know, existed for and gave back to all employees. So he actually turned in one of his retirement plans so that shares could be distributed to the Danone employees. So, you know, he tried to build a business that was focused on all stakeholders at its core. He ultimately was fired, I guess, you know, let go from his position. I think he was CEO for 7 years. And, you know, as you mentioned, some of the competitors had been performing better, and some activist investors, very small holders. I mean, it's sort of interesting how people that own less than 1% of shares in a company can actually make a lot of noise and lobby board members in order to get someone to step down. There's a lot of headwinds for business trying to do good and be sustainable. That if you're going to do it, you have to have the most sort of rock solid businesses possible. You can't just sort of talk about it and, you know, be aspirational. And, you know, you have to actually have the pieces put together inside your business. And this includes governance, includes incentives, includes, you know, a variety of other sort of measurement and transparency practices. That's a challenge for companies, because it's easy to say things, and changing internally is a lot harder.
Let's talk another point you make in the book, which is about employees. And I love when someone talks about the employees. And you say, when employees become the business, they thrive and their communities begin to thrive. And so why do you emphasize employees as a critical lever to rebalance a company's effectiveness and power with social responsibility?
I appreciate you liking that. And I think that this is something that I've always been in an organizational behavior department, which frequently has human resources. I think that in the social responsibility realm, employees are an undervalued asset. There's a lot of discussion of like brand lift and what type of, you know, reputational benefit. So people look, when companies are doing social responsible, you know, and sustainable activities, frequently looking outside to the brand of the company is where people think to look first. But I always think that actually the values of a company and what it means to work there and the purpose is so important.
I'd love you to talk about some other examples, and you talk about some that people don't know. I mean, you talk about Patagonia. So, I mean, Patagonia may be the ultimate purpose-driven company. We're here to save our, you know, our home planet Earth. But talk a little bit about some others. You talk about Toast Ale or Grayston Bakery. You know, why do they stand out, and what are they doing that we can learn from?
It's going to be maybe a future book that I do is how, you know, focusing on social innovation is like a level of creativity that is beyond, you know, what a lot of other businesses are doing. You know, you see this situation where people think having some new app or some new, you know, I don't know, sort of online tool is like really, really creative. But these social entrepreneurs are really sort of flying in the face of the standard business process and to actually find a way to make a product and service and succeed in that. It's obviously, you know, a level of creativity that's beyond what the other businesses are doing. But also, you know, in doing that, when you start connecting those dots, you actually learn a lot of other things. So Toast Ale is a UK-based, you know, beer company, and their interest is around circularity and actually helping fight food waste. So a bunch of the, I don't remember how to actually make beer, but some of the inputs they use actually are, you know, bread that would be discarded otherwise. And what they found is that actually they ended up collaborating with a lot of other breweries, and the other breweries said, "Oh, this is great. These breadcrumbs, we can totally use this in our brewing process." And so they ended up actually starting a side business, actually producing these, like, you know, discarded bread into an input for major beer companies' production. So that's one reason why I like, you know, them. It's sort of this, you know, how being responsible and thoughtful in your business can generate other opportunities around sort of circularity.
Yeah, you talk a lot about regenerative systems. Is there another company you want to mention that has this regenerative approach?
You mentioned Patagonia being maybe overdone, but I'm going to mention Patagonia. So Patagonia, you know, you mentioned their current, you know, vision or mission is, you know, we're in business to save our home planet. Actually, you know, up until maybe 2017, that was not their vision. That was not their mission statement. It was something it was longer, but also had the phrase in it, and do less harm. And when I interviewed Vincent Stanley, who is, you know, known as their director of philosophy, I think is his title, he told me, you know, when we got into the regenerative agriculture space, which was through their Patagonia Provisions, which is a variety of foodstuffs, he said, we realized that actually business and production could give back. It could actually generate positive effects, which is the sort of hallmark of regeneration. Said it totally transitioned our thinking. You know, we don't want to be in business to do less harm. We want to be in business to do better. And it said this actually was a huge impetus behind their, you know, sort of, you know, Black Friday, you know, don't buy this jacket, behind their movement into, you know, repairing products, promoting reuse, having a secondhand market, you know, using regenerative cotton. So really this like business model unlock that they had, I think is really important to highlight, because the natural way to do business is, again, sort of this take, make, waste model. But through some creativity, businesses actually can think of ways to close those loops and to actually give back.
So that's a very positive approach, which you kind of go through the first two parts of the profiteers to get to the rethinking and transformation of the entire system. So I love the way that you're really leaning into regenerative and creativity and the unlock, because I think that we work with so many companies and their employees are just dying to be unlocked to allow some new ideas.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Grayson Baker earlier, and that's, I think, a really important one, because it's not as much about, you know, environment. It's actually much more about, you know, social equity, inequality. And Grayson pioneered this idea of open hiring. So, you know, what open hiring is that you just show up and put your name on a list and you get hired. This flies in the face of traditional HR, where they do these things, you know, the background checks, do all this very invasive, detailed, you know, checking of people for jobs that really don't require, you know, a lot of that. And the truth is that a lot of these practices that are embedded into HR actually are subtle ways of actually reinforcing, you know, existing systems of discrimination and inequality. And so this idea of just having open hiring, it totally avoids all those issues. And it's a really powerful way to actually overcome, you know, discrimination in hiring. And one of the things, sort of like Toast Ale, that I think is really important is that Grayson has been very active in distributing that model to other companies. They have actually started a foundation that is active in promoting open hiring to many other businesses. For instance, the Body Shop, you know, which used to be part of Natura, but they recently sold it, also actually is very active in that practice as well, and a number of other businesses. And so, you know, it's these ideas that are creative in a way that they buck the traditional standards. Like the fact that HR, like some HR department, would think, oh, we're just going to basically let someone put their name on a list and hire them, you know, really probably that wouldn't go over well in traditional HR departments, but actually has worked very well for them. And I should note, you know, it doesn't mean you don't need any standards, but certain jobs, actually a lot of the screens that exist for them aren't needed and aren't necessary. And again, a way to just reinforce discrimination.
Yeah. And they're also hard to get by because it could be a drug, you know, arrest. Right. It could be formally incarcerated. We had a whole show on Grayson, so we're going to link that in the show notes.
Oh, fantastic.
So as we begin to wind this down, can you, in a finite way, and it's hard, I know, what is the playbook to recreate our economic system?
So I'll say a few things. As academics, we frequently try to boil things down and have, you know, sort of the 1, 2, 3. In this book, I actually, it might end up hurting the sales and my ability to talk about it. But I think that, you know, we are dealing with systemic problems and we need systemic solutions. And systemic solutions, there's not like sort of one silver bullet. One of the quotes I have in there that I really like is from Eisenhower, the World War II general and subsequent U.S. president. And someone asked him, you know, he was responsible for like the D-Day invasion and these massive, you know, logistical challenges. And they said, you know, how do you actually do those incredibly complex projects? And he said, whenever I see a project I can't do, I make it more complex. And that sort of flies in the face of typical, you know, sort of standard operating procedure. You want to look for the sort of easy wins or silver bullets or sort of break it down into small steps. And what he said is that, you know, if you just break things down, you won't see the big picture. That actually by making it more complex, you know, the outlines of actually what the underlying root causes are come into view. So in the book, I talk about how, you know, there's no silver bullets. What we need is multi-sectoral, many forces on many fronts type of thinking. This is policy. We've talked about some of this regarding, you know, accountability policy like the EU is doing, other policy around corporate governance. We need changes in investor norms. You know, I talk a bit in the book, we haven't a chance to talk about it yet, about this idea of universal ownership and other types of investment practices that are focusing investors on the system, not just on individual companies. I think companies play a huge role in this in creating innovation and new practices and new models. And I think, you know, I'm in the business school. I spend most of my time with business. So I focus a lot of attention there. But I do think these, you know, larger system-oriented things like the governments and investors are really important. And then finally, of course, consumers are also tremendously important to this. I think that a lot of times business, you know, that want to avoid responsibility, sort of try to say it's consumer, you know, the like idea of sort of litter bugs and, you know, personal carbon footprints are ideas that businesses put out in order to, you know, sort of avoid responsibility. So I don't want to say consumers should do everything, but I do think, you know, we all make, you know, tons of decisions a day around what to buy, what to support, what to vote for. And I think that we should always be keeping in mind, is this company a company that's doing well by the world? You know, is it a local business? I buy from a lot of B Corps because I know that they've been through that process. So I think that's, you know, that's the playbook is, there's not really a playbook, to be honest. It's actually okay. About the systemic change through multi-sector action.
Okay. So before we close, I want to ask you a couple of questions since you are wise and in academia, and it has to do with AI.
Okay.
AI. So my question is, what is the role of purpose in an AI-driven world?
Yeah, I think purpose is more important in an AI-driven world than a non-AI-driven world. You know, you have, I've been sort of seeing discussions and reading about, you know, things like human-centered AI, responsible AI. And I think that those are things where people are struggling with this idea that, you know, if there's some algorithm or machine that ends up making, you know, a lot of decisions, you know, we've seen these issues where bias can creep in through AI algorithms, where people can be treated unfairly. And so I think the purpose is so important in having humans sort of in the loop, as they say, is essential because, yeah, we want to make sure that any sort of, you know, technical system is working in ways that are for the benefit of society and humanity and the environment and not reinforcing some of the issues that exist.
As we close, and I, you and I could have a long conversation over many, many shows, so we'll have to do another one in the future before you do the next book. So what haven't I asked about The Profiteers? And I do want to say, why should people buy the book? Let's just get to a succinct answer. Why should people buy The Profiteers from you?
I think the main reason is that, you know, so many books are out there talking about how purpose can lead to profit. You know, there's scores of books with that almost exact same title. And I think in times that can occur, but I think that actually for the systemic issues we have today, climate change, biodiversity risk, inequality, et cetera, you know, we need to actually do a more thorough job of diagnosing the systemic issues. And that's what I try to do. I try to actually dig in to what some of the systemic issues that are underlying these common, you know, these big problems we have, and then sort of roles of business, policy, investors can play in solving them.
Okay, thank you. That was great. So I do give you the last word. And so anything else you want to add?
No, I just want to thank you, Carol. You know, I mean, it's you were an early influence in my sort of sustainability and social responsibility journey, and it's great to reconnect and talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you so much. And so I wish you so much success with the book. It's very, very well researched. It is in your face, which I think we need. And I can't wait to see what the next one's going to be. And so please stay in touch and continue to advance true, authentic, aligned, sustainable companies that truly want to do their best in the world as well. I love the creativity side because innovation in this field is sorely needed. So thank you, Chris Marquis, and good luck on your book tour.
Great. Thanks a lot, Carol.
This podcast was brought to you by some amazing people, and I'd love to thank them. Anne Hundertmark and Kristen Kenny at Carol Cohn on Purpose, Pete Wright and Andy Nelson our crack production team at True Story FM, and you, our listener. Please rate and rank us, because we really want to be as high as possible as one of the top business podcasts available, so that we can continue exploring together the importance and the activation of authentic purpose. Thanks so much for listening.